This is Women Road Warriors with Shelley Johnson and Kathy Takaro. From the corporate office to the cab of a truck, they're here to inspire and empower women in all professions. So gear down, sit back, and enjoy.
Welcome to Women Road Warriors. We're an award-winning show that works to inspire and empower women in every profession. Our goal is to power women on their road to success. We tackle all kinds of topics, and we work to encourage women to be their very best with informative guests and women who've been champions. I'm Shelley.
And I'm Kathy.
No topic is taboo on our show. We tackle the tough topics along with the not-so-tough topics, and we like to feature experts and celebrities who can assist women in being the very best they can be. According to DomesticShelters.org, 1 in 4 women in the United States will be targeted by an abusive partner in their lifetime. Nearly 1 in 5 murder victims in the United States were killed by an intimate partner. These are dire and shocking stats. Thousands of women every year seek refuge in domestic assault shelters. There was a time when these shelters were not available, and there was no place for women to go to escape their abuser. Believe it or not, it's only been 50 years since the first domestic assault shelter opened. Women's Advocates in St. Paul, Minnesota was the very first. It's been a major advocate for change. This shelter was instrumental in establishing legal protection for victim survivors and their children in Minnesota, as well as an active leader in some of the first domestic violence legislation in the United States. That included the Shelter Appropriation Act, which funds shelters, and the Domestic Abuse Act that gives people the ability to obtain a protection order without having to file for divorce or legal separation. With us today from Women's Advocates are Executive Director Holly Henning and Grants and Evaluation Manager Mary Beth Becker-Loss. Welcome, Holly and Mary Beth. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having us,
ladies.
Thank you for having us.
This is so awesome. And congratulations on your 50th anniversary. Your shelter has been such a blessing for women and their families. Isn't that right, Holly? I thought I'd start with you.
Yeah, I just want to really highlight and uplift all of the women who kind of trailblazed the way for us now to be where we are, hitting our 50th anniversary. I think, as you know, and kind of mentioned, our organization actually started out with a small group of women who were doing very grassroots initiatives and really, really set out to meet the needs of women in crisis after the legalization of no-fault divorce happened in the state of Minnesota. And really, it was a group of lawyers who put together a call. I guess it was like an answering machine and people could call in and then they would call back with the intention of giving information how to actually file for no-fault divorce. And what they were actually finding is that when women were calling, they were in these really extreme circumstances where their safety and their lives were in jeopardy. And so then the movement kind of happened to really start looking at safety and wholeness for women and moving forward to start fundraising and purchase that first shelter and really start moving the work forward. We were incorporated as a nonprofit in 1972, and then the first night of our shelter opened in 1974.
In St. Paul. And wow. What a blessing. You know what I find shocking? That it took until 1974 for there to be a domestic assault shelter. What did women do prior to that? I mean, they were kind of stuck. Wouldn't you agree, Mary Beth?
Absolutely. It is, we owe a great debt to the civil rights movement of the 60s for I can't speak for the founders, but we were the movement against violence against women had gathered a lot of momentum from the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement of the 1960s, and relied on a lot of the organizing knowledge that was developed during that time, and so I don't think that we would have had the momentum or the proof that large social movements worked and could generate change without those movements for racial equality and the anti-war movement. So we do owe a great debt to those folks. But yeah, before 1974, there was not there were homeless shelters that you could you, typically men would stay at for a night and you had to be out by morning, and that model still exists. But before that, or for domestic violence survivors, there was this attitude, and still is in many places, of, well, that's a personal problem. You make yourself stronger and you take it. And if you can't, then maybe you go stay at a family member's house until your husband comes to claim you because you are his property. What Women's Advocates Collective members were doing between 1972 and 1974, when we were able to purchase that shelter and move people in, was those women were taking survivors into their own homes. They were getting calls from women on their legal advice helpline saying, "I don't have anywhere to go. He's going to kill me." And they would go and pick that woman up, and she would sleep on their couch for a couple of nights. It was really a network of individual women helping individual women, or individual couples helping individual women. There was no standardized form, but there was this idea of no one is coming to save us. It's our job. It's our job to save us. Because there was no like federal protection or state protection for women who were leaving. So individuals really did have to take it upon themselves to put their own homes and safety in danger to support and protect other women who were in deep danger.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the bravery of just going to pick the woman up, they were subjecting themselves to potential violence from the perpetrator. Wow. That's amazing. I don't think a lot of people know this. I think people take a lot of things for granted today. And the fact that women had no place to go. And a lot of times, like you were saying, they'd have to go to family members. Well, a lot of times I would imagine they encountered go back home, be a good wife, right? Yeah.
I know my mom escaped my crazy stepfather in 1980 when I was 10 or 11, and we left Saskatchewan, and the actually social services had come to our home because my mother had told them that my stepfather was sexually abusing us, and instead of putting him in jail, they came to do a home visit and they put us on a train across Canada, and that was the end of that. Well, we started over with nothing. I mean, like absolutely nothing. Our toaster was a wire hanger folded in two. Our couch was a couple mattresses. Like it was just, there was no resources, no nothing for us. Like, so she had to work two, three jobs for to raise these, myself and my two sisters. It was horrible. I mean, he chased us down. He was just like, oh my God. So the fear, and you're trying to, get your life back. It's very difficult. So I understand it.
Yeah, and Kathy, you said that was in the 80s.
1980,
Yeah, and it is amazing how many similarities I am hearing in your story to a lot of the survivors that we work with in shelters still in the 2020s.
There's no help. There was no help at the time for from the government or anything. Like, mom had no resources, no nothing. And even in Canadian history, if you look, that it's I think the first domestic shelter was opened in 1973 and 74, but not only in big cities. So anybody that's rural, or forget it, you got nowhere to go. I mean, I started running away from home when I was 7 because the family violence was so bad. My very first place that I would that my hiding place was the dog house, because it was the only place no one would think to come look for me, So it's pretty sad.
Yeah, and I find it shocking that this sort of thing and the lack of accommodation for women and their families still goes on in the 2020s. Why is that?
Especially since COVID, it's been over full. The shelters are overflowing.
And we did have to reduce capacity in many ways too over COVID. But the question of why this is still happening is, I think there are systems in place that ha in this country and in much of the world that don't consider violence against women or domestic violence really to be a problem. I think there are people in power and there are systems of power that don't see anything wrong with the subjugation of women and children and gender expansive people. As I don't think they see anything wrong with that necessarily. And so if to them, to those structures that are in place, if there's no problem, then why would they implement a solution to something that they don't deem as particularly problematic? But I think if we imagine a better world where everybody gets to be cared for and where no human being deserves to live under power and control, if you recognize that what is happening is a problem, then you become driven to find those solutions.
Absolutely.
And I'm really grateful to our founders for sitting together and understanding this cannot stand, this cannot continue, and doing what they can with the resources they had. But I do think there are systems in place that just truly don't see anything wrong, with what is happening.
Which is amazing. We had a guest on who is fighting against gender-based violence, Charmin Prince. And what she's doing is just miraculous. And it is in the United States, it's across the world. Women are being marginalized left and right. You know, one of the stats I read a number of years ago in the United States, animals had rights before children. So you couldn't abuse an animal, then you couldn't abuse a child. Women are still at the back of the line. I don't get it. I just don't get it.
I just wanted to kind of echo and piggyback off of what Mary Beth was saying about some of the systemic issues. But also, I think a lot of times too, without resources, right? And without education and the ability to move forward in healing, we then often are seeing generational cycles of abuse, right? And so a lot of times, if you are a child that grew up in an abusive household, you are, more likely to also experience that when you're grown up. And so I think one of the other really unique things that Women's Advocates does very beautifully is through our children's program, we really, well, and actually kind of braided through all of our programs, is we really focus on the two generation healing and really ensuring that we're providing the education, the love, the services to both mom and the kiddos so that, we're giving them a toolkit to understand what healthy relationships are so that hopefully, we're not seeing them come to our shelter, 15, 20 years down the line. And I also just wanted to say thank you to Kathy for sharing some of your personal experience and your vulnerability. I think it's your voice and the stories of survivors that really, really carry the work forward and allow us the knowledge and the sharing of space to understand how we can best do the work and really centering survivor voice. So I also just wanted to say, Chimiigwech, thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, you're welcome. I think it's my personal experience of having literally a lifetime of domestic violence and, being strangled three times to the point of losing consciousness or living with a shovel on my porch as a reminder of what I was going to be buried with, and my experience in and out of various domestic shelters while I'm nursing, it taught me a lot. I was appalled. I don't know, in Whitehorse, Yukon, I worked up there at the hospital for 3 years and I was in and out of the shelter up there. And I was absolutely appalled at the lack of resources for the women. There was one group that I attended one a month, and which is not nearly enough. And the group women were the women who managed to make it. I was hearing some stories of being pulled behind skidoos for sport, and like, oh my God, like just these horrible stories, and these women have nowhere to go. And so what I do now is everywhere I travel, I make a point of going to any domestic shelter that I where whatever country I'm in, I'm like, bring me to the hood, bring me to the place that they need it the most. And I don't do it for money. It's about giving them hope, about giving them a bit of inspiration that all they got to do is, well, not all they have to do, but to look toward in their inner strength and their own courage, and that they can change, they can alter their destiny. But it takes a lot of work, and you have to, be courageous and keep putting that one foot in front of the other. Yes, you're going to be broke for a while. Yes, it's going to be hard, but it's a lot better at the end, to have your own independence than to keep running back to that same cycle.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned for more of Women Road Warriors coming up.
Dean Michael, the tax doctor here. I have one question for you. Do you want to stop worrying about the IRS? If the answer is yes, then look no further. I've been around for years. I've helped countless people across the country, and my success rate speaks for itself. So now you know where to find good, honest help with your tax problems. What are you waiting for? If you owe more than $10,000 to the IRS or haven't filed in years, call me now at 888-557-4020 or go to mytaxhelpmd.com for a free consultation and get your life back.
Industry movement Trucking Moves America Forward is telling the story of the industry. Our safety champions, the women of trucking, independent contractors, the next generation of truckers, and more. Help us promote the best of our industry. Share your story and what you love about trucking. Share images of a moment you're proud of and join us on social media. Learn more at truckingmovesamerica.com.
Welcome back to Women Road Warriors with Shelley Johnson and Kathy Takaro.
If you're enjoying this informative episode of Women Road Warriors, I wanted to mention Kathy and I explore all kinds of topics that will power you on the road to success. We feature a lot of expert interviews. Plus, we feature celebrities and women who've been trailblazers. Please check out our podcast at womenroadwarriors.com and click on our episodes page. We're also available wherever you listen to podcasts, on all the major podcast channels like Spotify, Apple, YouTube, Amazon Music, Audible, you name it. Check us out and bookmark our podcast. Also, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, LinkedIn, YouTube, and other sites. And tell others about us. We want to help as many women as possible. Domestic assault shelters did not exist as we know them until 50 years ago, with the creation of Women's Advocates in St. Paul, Minnesota. Even though we've made tremendous progress, there's still a great need across North America for women to go when they're trying to escape their abuser. Why does domestic violence continue? And why aren't there enough resources for women and families to escape it? Part of this is because there's still preconceived notions that violence against women isn't wrong. Entire cultures can think this way. Those mindsets don't encourage solutions nor change. We've got a long way to go to stop the subrogation of women. We're talking with Mary Beth Becker-Loth and Holly Henning from Women's Advocates, the first domestic assault shelter in the United States. It's commemorating its 50th anniversary this year. The people there provide so much, including incredible support and counseling to women who've been abused. That's so important, to empower women and families. Question is, what else is needed so we can stop society from thinking domestic assault is acceptable? Certainly, there's a lot being done to help women stop the cycle with counseling and group sessions and all of that.
I wish that we gave that same, this work is hard, but it is yours and it is worth it. Like, I wish we gave that same talk to abusers, actually. I wish there were people who would say, listen, like you may maybe you're doing this because you love the thrill of power and you love the thrill of making someone feel small, but your life could be better if you didn't do this. It's going to be hard work, but it is your responsibility to do what you can to not abuse and to not objectify and to not murder women. It's going to be hard work to change your mindset, but you have a moral obligation to change your mindset, and your life is going to be better and richer and fuller because of it. I wish there were men who were interested in doing that work publicly with other men. Because I think it is important to tell survivors that yes, we can imagine a better world for ourselves. Freedom is amazing and you deserve it and it's hard, but you can get there and we'll help you. But I've been thinking a lot about the necessity of engaging with the source of the problem.
Yep. Changing the mindset. Now, when a perpetrator is convicted, do they have programs in place to work with them on changing their mindset so that they understand, like you were saying, this is not appropriate and your life will be so much better if you don't do this sort of thing?
There are programs called batterer intervention programs. The I think one of the experts for those groups is Lundy Bancroft, who wrote Why Does He Do That? But then another program is the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project up in Duluth, Minnesota. And they do those court mandated or choice-based batterer intervention programs where they do talk about the roots of abuse and how to change the mindset. There is a lot of debate lately in scholarly communities about whether those programs work.
Why is there debate?
They're trying to decide. There's a camp that believes that domestic violence is solely due to misogyny, to hatred of women, and a desire for male supremacy. There is another camp that believes that anybody can perpetrate this, and it's a combination of family life, substance use, mental illness, stress, lots of comorbid factors that go into whether people abuse or not. And so there's a lot of debate about like what the best approach to a program like that would be, whether to take it as a misogyny-based program or a constellation of factors approach. But there's also research that abusers who take these programs can stuff down their behaviors long enough to pass a program and then return right back to the behaviors that terrorize the women and children in their life as soon as the program is over.
I think it's a two-part story. I think it's also part on the women who are being abused to recognize the signs at an early stage and not tolerate it. I say this when I speak at schools a lot to the youth because young girls are so vulnerable. But if you continue tolerating it, and it almost teaches them that it's okay to treat you poorly. You have to educate them how to treat you. I know today, maybe that's why I've been single for 6 years, but no, I just started dating someone. But it's because when I see the red flags, I don't put up with it anymore. But I'm 55, I'm not 15 anymore. So there's a big difference, right? So, but I try and teach the young girls, listen, if he's calling you names right there or telling you you don't look the right way or your hair is not right or you can't cook right or whatever, nothing you're doing is right. Well, that's a huge red flag. Don't tolerate it.
But we're so conditioned to
Oh,
tolerate,
I
right?
know.
Like
I know.
I was strangled almost every day of my life from ages 17 to 21, and I thought that I didn't get to say that I didn't want that. I thought that I just had to put up with it because I had spent my entire life being told, be a good girl, be a lady, be accommodating, don't say no, be easy, get along. And that kind of conditioning in girls makes it so scary to say no, even if you're not in any danger. Like sometimes I'm scared to say no if I no to an extra glass of water at a restaurant. Like I don't want to hurt somebody by saying no. And so like you put that into a situation, you put that conditioning into a situation where there are actual physical stakes involved. And of course I'm just going to go along to get along. And so I think that conditioning is something that like we all have a duty to not expect of girls anymore.
Amen to that. Now, thank you for sharing that, Mary Beth. From what I was reading, both you and Holly have personally experienced domestic violence. So, I mean, you really understand what the women coming to you are going through, and you know what the dynamics are. Holly, were you also conditioned to deal with this and consider this acceptable behavior?
Yeah, I think so. As a Native woman, I think there's a lot of stigma, right, around, and especially like in small community, right? Like being able to call people out or just knowing like, oh, well, that person is still gonna live on that reservation, or they're still gonna show up to that powwow that you're gonna be at, or they're still gonna be in this space with you sometimes makes it, I think, pretty hard to be able to like have the courage to come out and call people out or kind of make some of that change happen. And I think a lot of times it's like when you're like when I was talking about like the generational pieces, right? And a lot of what I'm talking about, right, is also rooted in historical trauma that's occurred with Native communities, right? Is that there were large amounts of abuse that occurred in the boarding school systems and the residential school systems across the United States and Canada, which also led to substance abuse, physical violence, sexual violence within our communities. And so for some families, this is stuff that I don't want to use the word normalized, but has just been reoccurring, right? And so being able to like speak out against that and try and break those cycles was really important to me once I had a child, and ensuring, that that's not the direction that my son goes in his life. And so I think a lot of it, yes, is conditioning. A lot of it, just from my own personal lens, is also rooted in historical trauma, and things that have happened within Native community over generations. So.
So basically, it comes down to breaking the cycle by teaching what is appropriate behavior. That's a tough one, depending on, the different cultures, how people have grown up. I mean, when you're going through this, and especially when you're a child observing this, you think it's just that's the way life is. You don't know it's wrong.
Yeah, you just and we talk a lot about that in our educational in our trainings about how yeah, you don't know as a kid that other people's parents don't fight until the walls shake. Like you just don't know that. You think that is normal. And so I think what is really important is to talk about it, is to be really vocal because that's how this movement started, right? Like women decided they were tired of being told to just shut up and take it because what happens in your home is a private matter. They decided, no, this affects all of us. This is just a microcosm of what all women everywhere are dealing with. And if we start to talk about it, we can start to change it. Domestic violence and all kinds of abuse thrive on isolation and secrecy and shame. Those are the things that allow it to spread and continue. And so if we want to break that If we want to break that cycle, if we want to end DV for good, we really do have to never stop talking about it. Mm-hmm. We have to say, no, this is something that happened in my life. I realize now that it's not normal or that it wasn't healthy, but I grew up thinking this was the way that it is. And now that I know better, I have the tools to, I can find the tools to do better. Or now that I know that it's wrong, I have, I can look for other ways of being. I can find inspiration in the way that other people's relationships work. But to do that, we have to be really, we have to have be having conversations with each other about what healthy does look like.
Stay tuned for more of Women Road Warriors coming up.
Trucking Moves America Forward, or TMAF, is building a positive image of trucking by telling the story of the hardworking drivers and industry professionals who support the industry. And you can be a part of it. Learn more about TMAF and how you can join and be a part of the industry movement working to build a strong image of trucking by visiting TMAF's website at truckingmovesamerica.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our latest channel, TikTok.
Welcome back to Women Road Warriors with Shelley Johnson and Kathy Takaro.
So much work is being done to stop the cycle of domestic abuse. Much of this is retraining generations of bad behavior. Intervention is one step. Education is another. There's so many aspects, from the judicial system on down to the family unit, where change needs to begin. Re-educating the perpetrator is a huge element. Women will never be fully free until it's not okay for them to be victims of domestic assault. Women's Advocates in St. Paul, Minnesota is the very first domestic assault shelter in the United States. They're also fearless advocates for women, with many programs in place to help women and families overcome the cycle of abuse and empower themselves. They offer all kinds of resources to women, and a large part of the staff at Women's Advocates are survivors of domestic violence themselves, so they understand what their residents have experienced. It's that kind of empathy that creates an environment of trust for positive, supportive change. Women learn that they do not have to tolerate violence of any kind. They're taught what violence is and what is not. Too often, they really don't know the difference. They've been socialized to believe it's normal. It's essential we talk about domestic violence. It thrives on isolation, secrecy, and shame. Change happens when it's brought out into the open and called out for the blight that it truly is on humanity. Mary Beth and Holly, you know, you're doing so many wonderful things at your shelter. You've got so many programs in place for women and the families. You've got things like violence prevention and education, shelter and healing, safety after shelter. I love the support system that you're providing here. Did you want to talk a little bit about what you're doing? Because I really think that you are a wonderful example for shelters across the country.
Yeah, one thing that I would really like to highlight, in addition to some of the programs that you just mentioned, was really ensuring that our organization is truly survivor-led. We have survivors at all levels of the organization. Myself as the executive director, a very large percentage of our support team, which would be like our leadership team. We also have 60% of our board members identifying as survivors of domestic violence. But we also have what's called a Survivor Advisory Council. We work with a group of amazing folks who have actually been through our programs, whether it's our emergency shelter, our children's program, or are engaged in our housing stability work. And we come together on a monthly basis. We have a work plan, and we actually pay those survivors for their expertise, right? And in that time and in that space, not only are they building like support and networking with each other as other survivors, but also they're really helping our organization in what areas and priorities we need to be focusing on. So like one of my favorite examples to give is we had a survivor bring a suggestion to our Survivor Advisory Council about us prioritizing women who are seeking shelter but have animals. Previously, we were unable to do anything for the animal, right? We would say, hey, we'll take you as the survivor or you and your kiddos, but we, you know, we just don't have the means right now. And we would try and give exterior resources, right? But because our Survivor Advisory Council said, hey, like there's so many women who do not enter shelter because our pets are a barrier for shelter. We're worried that the abuser might hurt the animal, injure the animal, kill the animal, or use it as a way to get me to come back and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to form a connection with the bond between, and we were able to start our own pet foster program. And so now any person who would like to enter our shelter who has a pet, we have like a safety net in place so that they can make sure that their pet is safely housed while they are also safely housed and getting the support and the services that they need. And this was one of like many amazing things that have come out of the work with our Survivor Advisory Council. One of the two other really cool initiatives were the need for chemical health support. Like we have so many women, right, who either were introduced to drugs and alcohol through an abuser, right? They got them hooked on something while they were in the relationship so that they could continue to assume power and control. And so when they come to us, they're really struggling. Other times people use it as a coping mechanism, right? And so we had the suggestion from our Survivor Advisory Council to really dive in and get some additional chemical health supports. And we were actually able to go after grant funding and are really excited that we are hiring a licensed drug and alcohol counselor who is starting with us the first week of April, who can really facilitate some CD groups, can help link people to medicated treatment if that's what they need, can help do chemical health assessments, right? If that's what that survivor needs at that point in time. And so to me, I think just the fact that we are truly survivor-led really sets the bar high for the work that we're doing and really ensuring that we're hearing an uplifting survivor voice in all aspects of the work that we do. And I'm sure Mary Beth may have some more to add because she's been involved with the Survivor Advisory Council longer than I have as well.
Oh man, amazing. I don't have as much to add other than that group is just incredible. It's my favorite meeting of the month because these women, like, yes, we pay them, but they don't work for us. They don't have to show up, but they choose to keep coming to this monthly meeting because they enjoy each other and also they trust us. What is really honestly like sacred to me about that group is that they trust us with to tell us what has been frustrating to them about their experience or what has been like dear or treasured to them about their experiences. They trust us to do right by their story and to do what they are asking us to do. And as like, I'm sure you know, part of the thing that abuse really, the tragedy of abuse is really that it destroys your ability to trust other people and also to trust yourself. And so to be an organization that is trusted by people who have had their trust in others absolutely obliterated is A, it's huge progress for all of them. Like, I'm just thrilled that they can even feel that sense of belief in an institution, an organization of all things. But also, I'm just really honored that they keep coming and saying, hey, we know that you have the tools to fix this. Let's fix this. And it just makes me want to do anything for them forever because they're just because they know that we take them seriously and they know that they deserve to be taken seriously. It's really beautiful.
I find your organization absolutely amazing. I mean, you really are setting the bar on caring for survivors of domestic assault. You're offering a safe place that empowers them. Maybe this is the first time in their lives they've ever been empowered.
Yeah, it's an honor, and we can't, like, we don't dish out power like pieces of pie to people when they come into shelter. That is something that they have to, they find. And if we're lucky, if we're good at our jobs, they find it while they're with us. They get to find that little nugget that wasn't taken away from them, and they get to grow it. And really what we do, the whole point of trauma-informed and survivor-centered advocacy is to say, like, hey, I see that little nugget of power within you, even if you don't, and tell me what you need. I will just sit back and give it to you, but also I will let that little nugget grow. I'm going to give you the space and the choice on how you want to grow that power. And I think that's something that our advocates do really well is say, hey, you've already got it in you. I'm just going to sit back and let you, like, I'll give you what you need, but you're going to grow that power your own self. And there's nothing that I'm going to do to stop you.
I love that.
Stay tuned for more of Women Road Warriors coming up.
Kathy DeCaro is nothing short of amazing. She not only drives the world's biggest truck as a heavy equipment operator in northern Alberta, Canada, she's an international motivational speaker and the author of Dream Big, an autobiography about overcoming a lifetime of trauma and abuse that led to dreams of success. Kathy inspires people the world over to change their lives and improve their self-worth. Her book will change your life. She's passionate about personal growth and believes anyone can change their circumstances and overcome their obstacles if they believe in themselves. Her life will amaze you and seriously inspire you. Be sure to order a copy of her book, Dream Big, on Amazon.com. Industry movement Trucking Moves America Forward is telling the story of the industry. Our safety champions, the women of trucking, independent contractors, the next generation of truckers, and more. Help us promote the best of our industry. Share your story and what you love about trucking. Share images of a moment you're proud of and join us on social media. Learn more at truckingmovesamerica.com.
Welcome back to Women Road Warriors with Shelley Johnson and Kathy DeCaro.
Women's Advocates, the first domestic assault shelter in the United States, sets the bar and is a stellar example of the help that domestic assault survivors need. They provide all types of resources with things like a survivor advisory council, emergency shelter, children's program, housing stability program. They even have a place where women fleeing domestic abuse can safely house their pets. Their programs offer women a safe place where they can become empowered without interference. It's a place of growth that's helping stop the cycle of violence against women, one resident at a time. Holly and Mary Beth, I am so inspired by what you all are doing. For people who would like to help out, I'm sure that people would like to donate. What does your shelter need so that we could continue this momentum that you and your founders created back in the 70s? And certainly I would like people to be aware of what you're doing because I think you are a wonderful example of what can be done nationwide.
So I would say, I mean, one of the biggest things, you know, as a nonprofit, we're always, always, always looking for and asking for dollars, right? So about 40-ish percent of our funding is all private, right? So that's individual donors, that's potentially like a private foundation, right? And then the other 60% is generally government grants, right? So we do always have a big portion of dollars that we're trying to fundraise year round, right? For just general operations for the programs and the services that we offer to survivors. So I would say, like, one, that would be amazing if folks have capacity to give in that way. But also we have different opportunities listed on our website. If folks are in the Twin Cities area, they do have different volunteer days that we offer on our website quarterly for groups to come out or individuals to come out. Definitely, like, you know, if you have a specific skill set that you might be able to, like, offer to us pro bono or something like that, we're always open. We're very creative with ideas and how we can bring different talents and minds to the work. And then I know we also have an Amazon wish list that's posted on our website, which kind of highlights the different needs that we have at different times for survivors in our programs. So, like, sometimes, you know, we just need donations for, like, general hygiene supplies, right? Or diapers for kiddos who are staying in our shelter, or new furniture, or different things like that. So we make sure to keep those lists pretty updated as different needs come up throughout the year. And I don't know, Mary Beth, if you have anything else to add.
I just heard that we're looking for new leggings in all sizes right now. As folks come into shelter, they usually come in needing clothing. And so a particular need right now is women's leggings in various sizes. That's a donation need. But I also, I think on the prevention and education side of things, if people want to get involved, I think it's what they can do is, A, be mindful that there are probably survivors in your life who haven't told you that they are survivors. And so being mindful and respectful about how you talk about victim survivors of domestic violence, or how you talk about domestic violence and sexual assault, I think it's really important to remember that there are that we're everywhere, and we hear you and we're listening, and so to be mindful of how you speak about domestic violence and sexual assault. And I think it's also important to be good bystanders. If there are people in your life who are potentially being abusive or controlling to a partner or a child, I think it's important to take that person aside and say, "Hey, man, I love you. I want you to be happy. I want your life to be successful. And I don't think this is the way to do it." So being brave in that way, and being a brave, safe bystander will also help you show up for the survivors in your life that you may not know about.
Wonderful advice. Well said, Mary Beth.
Yeah.
Mary Beth and Holly, you folks are absolute champions. And what your organization is doing is just phenomenal. Where do people find you on the web?
We are on the internet at wadvocates.org. We are on Facebook at Women's Advocates. And we are on Instagram at Women's Advocates.
I love what you're doing. And thank you so much for being on the show. I could talk to you for another hour.
Oh, my God.
There's so much to unpack with this topic, but I am just super impressed with what your organization does.
I'm blown away. Honestly, I am. Thank you so much for every single thing that you do.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's an honor to be here and share space with you both.
Likewise. Thank you for being on the show. We hope you've enjoyed this latest episode. And if you want to hear more episodes of Women Road Warriors or learn more about our show, be sure to check out womenroadwarriors.com. And please follow us on social media. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Women Road Warriors is on all the major podcast channels like Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Audible, YouTube, and others. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Women Road Warriors with Shelley Johnson and Kathy Takaro. If you want to be a guest on the show or have a topic or feedback, email us at sjohnson@womenroadwarriors.com.